You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. This is Steve Bertrand, and I'm so glad you're here. You know, the trials and tribulations of a retired Chicago police detective as he settles into small-town Ireland might not be the first thing you think of when you think of Irish writer Tana French, but it is for me, and I think maybe it should be for you. She's wrapping up her Cal Hooper trilogy with her latest. It's called The Keeper, and it's going away despite my best efforts to keep it going. Tana, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Hi.
Well, I've got to tell you, I got to start with a little disappointment because I really enjoy the Cal Hooper series, and it's coming to an end.
Yeah, it's time. I mean, it's set in a small town. If I keep killing people off, it's going to go full Murder, She Wrote. You know?
Well, you keep bringing people in to kill maybe sometimes too. How do you know when it's over?
This one, it was kind of to do with the arc of the trilogy because I wasn't planning a third book. And then I realized the first one, The Searcher, was about Cal being an outsider in a small town and kind of navigating all these generations-old codes and rules that he had no way of understanding. And the second book, The Hunter, was about people who kind of live in this liminal space between outsider and insider, like Cal settled in, but not really, and Trey, the half-feral teenager who he's sort of raising, she's from that family who everybody agrees that it would be better if they weren't around.
Right.
And Lena, his fiancée, she really has spent her adult life keeping herself as distant from the townland as she can. So they're all operating on that borderline between outsider and insider with all its sort of vulnerabilities and its strange power. So I figured I need to finish off this arc with a book about what it means to be an insider, what that offers and what demands it makes. What does it mean when you really belong somewhere? So once I'd done that, it felt like we were done here.
Well, I don't think we're done here, Tana. I think you need to do some work. Come up with an idea. We should say Cal is a former, I'm sitting in Chicago or in the suburbs, a former Chicago detective who sort of retires in The Searcher, right, to reconfigure his life in a way.
Yeah, he's looking for peace and a kind of moral simplicity because he's realized that his job as a Chicago detective is not as morally clear-cut as he initially thought it was and as he would have liked it to be. And there's a line in the first book in The Searcher, he's realized that one of them, him or the job or both, can't be trusted. So he takes early retirement, heads to this remote Irish village, hoping that he'll get peace and moral clarity. And obviously, it does not work out like that.
You said The Searcher was meant to originally to be a standalone. I saw a quote from you that said, you realize there, I love this line, there was more candy in the piñata.
Yeah, basically. I mean,
and so you went back to it.
Yeah, it's a small Irish village. These places are packed with stories, with relationships that go back generations, with secrets, some of them a lot darker than others. And I felt like I liked this place. I wanted to spend more time picking out the layers that were lying beneath it.
The name of the town, you're going to have to help me here. Ardna Kelty,
yeah.
Ardna
yeah,
Kelty,
it's made up. It's not real, sure. I promise.
Oh, I know. I looked for it on the map. I couldn't find it anywhere. And it's really, I think in this book, more than the others, a real character.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Oh, I really hope so, because I love places. I think it has to do with, I grew up moving all over the world, right? So you get a really strong sense of place that way, because each place is attached to a different stage of your life, a different set of memories. And they're all so deeply rooted in specific places that are often no longer part of your life in any way. So that sense of place is really important to me. And I would love this little village with all its kind of slightly odd characters and tensions and odd priorities. I'd love it to be another character in the book.
You talked about traveling around a different, you've been in Ireland for more than 30 years now, right?
Oh, yeah. No, Ireland, I've been here since 1990. So I'm settled here. And if anywhere is home, it's Ireland. But I still kind of have a little bit of that outsider viewpoint, which is useful for a writer.
Are you still American? Have your citizenship?
Yeah, I still have my citizenship. But I'm a dual national.
How long did you live here?
I don't remember it very well. I've got to admit, I was born there, lived in Vermont till I was 2. Then we went off to Florence for a year, and then I lived in Washington, D.C. till I was 7. But I haven't lived in the U.S. since I was 7, so I kind of feel a little weird even claiming to be American.
Well, you know, I'm asking, I guess, because My one train of thought was that from what I know of Ireland and the small towns in Ireland, they can be not always so welcoming, or welcoming on the surface, but not deep down, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's a joke that the definition of a blow-in, a stranger, is somebody who's only been living here 50 years. So yeah, it takes a long time to really belong.
And so in thinking of that, I'm like, well, are you less equipped to write about that if you're not from there? But maybe if you're not from there, you're better equipped to write about that because you see it from a different perspective.
Well, I think definitely there's that element. I think it's an advantage for an author to not really belong in the place they're writing about, because things that somebody who's local would take for granted, you don't. You notice mm-hmm. them. Little cultural tinges, like how people joke with each other, what the social hierarchies are and how they're expressed, what's considered to be polite or rude or aggressive or anything like that. If you're from there, you take that for granted as the natural order of things.
One of the things,
if
you're not, it takes a while.
Yeah, well, you have to be good at noticing it, because otherwise you're going to make a mess.
And I feel like, too, you can be fooled in a small town going in, right? You can feel the embrace to your face, but it takes a while to get the true embrace.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we idealize. If you go somewhere new, you see the beauty on the surface, and especially... Listen, rural Ireland is so beautiful. And that's what you see. You see how lovely it is and how friendly and chatty the people are. And only gradually do you realize that you're not even being let past the front gate, never mind being let inside. And that
right.
takes a lot of time.
These are written, you said, and this surprised me as well, as sort of Westerns, like American Westerns. And put some meat on that bone for me, because I'm not sure I quite understand that.
Well, what happened was somebody introduced me to the amazing Lonesome Dove about, 9 years ago or something. And I read a few more Westerns and went, man, the setting and the tropes of these map really well onto the West of Ireland. Like there's this harsh terrain that demands toughness, and there's this visceral connection to it. And there's also this world where you are so remote from the centers of power that you feel like the people in power don't care about you. If you
right.
want a cohesive society, you've got to make your own rules. And that shows up a lot in Irish literature, in Irish drama and fiction. And I'd love to see how some more Western tropes map onto the West of Ireland. You know, the stranger in town who blows into the saloon with secrets of his own and things change around him. That kind of thing, I'd love to see how it maps onto the West of Ireland.
That literally happened in The Hunter, right? I think it was Johnny was his name. Starts his reappearance by walking into the pub.
Yeah, exactly. And he brings with him a gold rush, which is also, you know, a very Western
there it
thing.
Is. Yeah.
But we have had them in Ireland. So there's more of a match than you'd think between the two genres.
Okay, so Lena, you mentioned, Lena is Cal's romantic partner. They live separately. Cal lives on his own as well. And you mentioned Trey. Trey is this young girl in the earlier books who's somewhat feral, I think you just described her as, and Cal is good for her, and I think she's good for Cal too. She's sort of the, she doesn't live with Cal. She lives with her family, her mother, but spends a lot of time there and becomes sort of a surrogate project for Cal.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the beginning in The Searcher, when she shows up in his back garden demanding that he find her missing brother, that's the last thing he wants to do. He doesn't feel like he's in any position. He doesn't want to be a detective. Doesn't want to be anything like a detective. And he feels like he's very morally compromised. And Trey won't let go. She won't leave him alone
right.
until he goes out there and finds her brother. But by this time, their relationship has kind of morphed a little bit, and it's become, for Cal, I don't like to say exactly a form of redemption, but definitely a feeling that Trey is somewhere where he can do things right.
Right, right.
They're kind of helping each other along the way.
I mean, Cal has a daughter back in the States, in Seattle, I think it is. We don't know too much about that relationship, how that has gone, but Trey is, it's maybe not his second chance, but you're right, it's his chance to do good in a town where he's looking to do good.
He likes fixing things. You know, again, this is a Western thing, is the characters don't tend to be much about introspection and self-analysis and, you know, thinking about their own inner workings. They do stuff. And Cal is like that. He thinks in terms of actions. It doesn't matter what you think. It doesn't matter what you believe. It matters whether you do the right thing. So he's just trying to do things right.
I want to talk about Lena because it seems to me that more than anyone, it seems to me anyway, interested in what you think, that this is Lena's story.
I think she's much more at the center than she has been before, yeah, because she is someone who's struggled with this townland, which can be a pretty cruel place, and with the idea of being part of it. She would have left years ago, except she fell in love with a guy who was from here and who had no intention of leaving. She's a widow now, but this relationship between her and the townland has been the most tense and fraught part of her life, because she is very serious about setting up barriers so that this townland can't get inside her head. But in this book, that's not really an option anymore. She's kind of forced to confront that she does need to engage with this place, and that does mean letting it inside her life to an extent, and that that's not as terrible a thing as she always thought.
And here you have this woman who has kept the town at a distance, and all of a sudden she starts to engage it, and right away the suspicions rise. What's this woman? What does this woman want from us now?
Yeah. Well, what does she want? And also, she's odd, because in small communities like that, the person who deliberately keeps himself apart always becomes a focus for suspicion. I think, you know, you can go back hundreds of years and have people being accused of being witches, being accused of being, you know, all kinds of strange things because they keep themselves apart. And so when she starts engaging in any way with what's happened, which is a young woman has been found drowned in a river and Cal is trying to figure out what happened to her. When Lena starts engaging, she very easily becomes a focus for suspicion. And when someone decides to use that and pile the suspicion in her direction, it's very easy for it to flow that way.
Cal says that he knows there are rooms he couldn't enter when it comes to her life. She's closely, they're very close, but she's closely guarded too.
Oh, yeah. And he hasn't minded up until this point. He's been okay with that because the parts she does let him into are wonderful. And, you know, they care a lot about each other. They're good to each other. But he's starting to realize that the bits she hasn't let him into are going to play a role, whether either of them likes it or
right.
not.
The girl goes missing. And I have to ask you, one of the characters, one of the people from the town say that he heard the banshee the night she disappeared. Right?
Yeah.
You're a blow-in, only there 36 years. Do you believe in the fairies?
I'm going to go with Cal's take when Trey asks him whether he believes in ghosts, which is no, but it's not my landscape. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying that they're not there. You know, it's not mine to make that call.
That's the way all of you Irish answer that question.
No, I've been here a while, right?
Yeah, no one believes in the fairies, but they don't not believe in them either.
Yeah, well, you don't cut down that thorn tree and maybe you don't mow that hill, but you don't believe in the fairies. It's 2026, right. But you're still not cutting the grass on that hill.
You're not going to tempt fate.
No.
I want to talk about Mart, the character we haven't mentioned yet. And I want to talk about him through the first two books and the first 100 pages of this. I have no interest in later developments. And I had this thought, well, I think I probably had it each time I read one of the books, is that I'm not sure if I'm supposed to like this guy or not.
Oh, good.
Right? Yeah, he's the neighbor of Cal. He calls him Sonny Jim. He calls him all kinds of, you know, sort of American cliches. He's always laughing with him, but I never really trusted him or trust him.
Oh, good. You shouldn't. He's not particularly trustworthy. I really enjoyed writing Mart because he does walk on that borderline of, is this someone who is, you know, on the side of good or of evil? What side is he on? And I think that gradually it becomes clear that underneath all the joking and the way he uses language as a form of trickery and humor as a form of trickery and the way he doles out information only as needed and only as is useful to him, under all that, he cares deeply about this place. And that's his one core objective, is to keep this place safe.
He doles out information carefully, but he's always taking in as much as he can.
Oh, yeah. This is a one-way transaction as much as possible for him.
He doesn't share. Mrs. Duggan. Is it Duggan? So she might be Mart accentuated. And I don't know if she's a good person or bad person either.
I think she's a different thing because Mart has things he really cares about and is willing to make sacrifices and do whatever it takes for this place, you know, the community around him. He is willing to do whatever it takes for that community. Mrs. Duggan, on the other hand, is just, she's old, she's housebound, she's always been the person who likes taking in information and selling it at very high prices. I don't think she has any agenda other than her own entertainment with this. Yeah. So for her, it's a very cold, very amoral thing. There are no priorities underlying it.
If there's an evil act in this movie, in this book, it comes from her.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it comes from her just seeing everything around her as something that's there for her entertainment.
Yeah. Do you see that the characters that you describe in the book, I would imagine, I mean, did you have a particular town in mind when you wrote this book? Did you have particular people in mind?
No. I want to make that very clear. Although my brother sent me a screenshot a while back of two people arguing over which small town in the West this was based on. And I love that because, again, I live in Dublin. So here's me going, I'm going to write about rural Ireland. That's a big thing to take on if you're not actually from there. And I did a lot of research. I have friends who are from there. I talked to them, listened to all their stories, got them to vet the book for me. I read every message board on the whole internet that has to do with Irish farmers, with the West of Ireland, trying to get this right. So when I get that screenshot going, no, it's this town, no, it's that town, it's a huge relief because it means I did something right.
Where are your readers? Are they predominantly in the States? Are they in Ireland? Or where's your reader base?
I think the books do well in the US and in Germany are the two main places. There are readers in England and Ireland, New Zealand, apparently Australia, but the US, I think, is the main reader base, which is lovely.
Yeah, we're talking to Tana French. The name of her latest is The Keeper, and it's the final book installation of I'm calling it the Cal Hooper series. I don't know. Do you have is that a name for it? Or
yeah, that works. I don't have an name for you.
Here's a weird question. Does it matter for you how your readers picture your characters physically? And excuse me, but I ask this because I have the hardest time. I end up picturing people in my life or pick people I've seen on TV or movies for my characters that aren't always true to the writer's description. And I try, but I can't shake the way I picture a particular character. How is the author, as the person who creates the physique and the look is often part of the story. How do you react to that?
For me, there are certain things about the characters that I do want to get across to the reader, but the details, no, the details, the reader's going to find some details that to them match who this character is. Like I wouldn't want the reader necessarily picturing Cal as a little wiry guy, for example, because in my head, he belongs in this Western visual where he's a big guy who is physically able to be active and do things. And I, in the same way, I wouldn't want them picturing Mart as this huge, big, like muscle-bound guy, right? Because it wouldn't fit with his personality. He's slippery, he's small, he's able to dodge and duck and dive. So then picturing a big muscular guy wouldn't match. But I give just enough description that, okay, we're on the same page. But from there, no, you guys take it from there.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because my images of the characters are exactly as you just described. But
great.
Confession here, Cal to me is the American actor Brian Dennehy.
Oh, that works.
Does it work for you?
Yeah,
because then there's a scene where he's 50 years old and trim or something like that. And I'm like, oh, that's not what she was thinking.
Well, he's 50, but you know, Brian Dennehy was 50 not that long ago. And that kind of physique and that kind of face and that kind of energy where it's like he is a powerful presence. Yeah, I love that for Cal.
Okay, good, good. I scored on that one. Yeah, you talked about Mart and how he cares about the land. And there's a line in the book. I don't know if it's Cal saying it or who saying it, but it says, "These people find their way of life turning into a myth before their very eyes." Right. So what you're describing, the small town, the townland, is it a disappearing thing in Ireland?
It's under threat. And that's the other reason for this book, is that a lot of Western series have a book about the death of the West. And this whole way of life that I'm writing about in these books, yeah, it's under threat. Farmers are finding it harder and harder to make a living. There are like big corporations buying up farmland, making it unaffordable for the individuals. There's schools closing everywhere because there aren't enough kids. There are young people emigrating because they can't get housing here.
Right, right.
And so this whole way of life is being eroded. And that's what Mart's putting his finger on. And that's what I wanted to write about, because it felt like I've been writing about this way of life for two books now, and it seemed like really dishonest to just skip off somewhere else without engaging with this existential threat to that way of life.
It's, Ireland's gone through a bit of a cruel history, well, obviously, but more recently with the Celtic Tiger, right? Everything was grand, and we were there, and I went to a guy who was a bread truck driver, and yet he had a holiday house on the coast. You know, and those holiday houses or those trailers, they popped up everywhere, and then the rug sort of swept out from under them. And what's the residual effect there on the people from that?
I think there's still a residual effect, but it hasn't been the one you would have liked, because the Celtic Tiger was built on the idea that whatever is good for banks and developers must be good for the country as a whole. Mm-hmm. And we found out with the crash that that is not, in fact, true. That is definitely not the case. And I would have loved to see us learn from that and go, okay, no, we need to prioritize individuals having homes, having security, having jobs. But we haven't in the way that we would like. But there is still that sense of precariousness, that things can be whipped away very, very easily. It doesn't feel particularly safe or stable.
There's not a permanence.
Not in the way that you would want. And I think it also has to do with the fact that we've got an odd relationship between past and present with Ireland, because, you know, hundreds of years of colonization, the past isn't necessarily something that we have a deep affection for. But at the same time, once you start just erasing the past, throwing it away for anything that comes along, like, you know, ditching heritage sites because some company wants to build a data center on top of it, then you're in a kind of dangerous position, because you're risking making the same mistakes over and over rather than building on the lessons that have been learned.
It's interesting, too. So you're, in a way, trying to hang on to what was a very unfortunate history in many ways, rather than destroy it. So it's always a reminder of how things were bad for so many centuries, and yet it's not something you want to toss away.
No, there's a balance that you want to have between past and present and future, and you want to be able to acknowledge and incorporate the past into whatever comes next. But that's a hard thing to do when there's so many demands flying at you from the present and the future, and when the past, yeah, is pretty ambiguous.
Another line in the book from, I think this came from Noreen, Lena's sister, and they were talking about, and she's on the level of gossip, maybe just below Mart and well below her mother-in-law, Mrs. Duggan. But she talked about the United States, and she said, they're mental over there. Their police have guns and all.
Yeah.
Right? What? And there's this idea, this romantic relationship between the U.S. and Ireland. But what's the view from Ireland these days?
It's complicated because, again, everybody here has relatives in the US, has family over there. A lot of people have been over and back. But definitely, I've got to say, the idea of an ordinary, like, policeman out on the beat carrying a gun, that's wild to us. Mm-hmm. That implies an entirely different society and an entirely different sense of how you operate within your own society. Like, if the guy who pulls you over at a traffic stop has a gun, that's not the same as what we're used to at all. So there is that sense of America being keyed tighter than Ireland, being more fraught and more, what's the word? A very different relationship with authority.
Yeah, I'm interested in empathy a lot these days. What the world needs now, right?
Yeah,
and
big time.
The book, maybe it was The Searcher, you were doing an interview at that, and you said, I was thinking about luck and empathy and the connection between the two, how having too much luck can sort of stunt the empathetic emotion. Which, you know, so what we have are the people who've had the most luck sometimes having the least empathy, and that they think that everyone else should be in the position they are, while not recognizing the incredible fortune that brought them there.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. I think it's very easy if you've been lucky to just assume that whatever your perspective on the world is, whatever your experience of the world is, that's what everyone else is in, is that they live in the same world that you live in. And of course, that is not true in any way. People can follow parallel lives every day in the same city, doing the same job, and have utterly different experiences right. of what the world is. And I think one of the whole points of what I do, of writing, is that it gives readers and me a chance to try and see the world through somebody else's perspective. And the more we do that, the more we realize that there are other people out there living their experience of the world differently, seeing it differently. Just every single thing is not the same as ours, and that their experience is as vivid and as vital and as real as ours.
And, you know, I'll tell you, I'll disagree with you just a little bit in that I was just back from El Salvador, where I work with a clinic where we fit people with eyeglasses and things like that. And while it's true that the people of El Salvador live vastly different lives than we do here in the States or in Ireland, we behave so similarly. We have so, I mean, Tana, I just melt with these little kids coming up, you know, and I can make them laugh without sharing a language, right? Or you can hug someone in joy without sharing a language. We share so much that unfortunately we don't always take the time to recognize or realize.
Oh, yeah. Underneath, just the emotions and the capacity for love and the capacity for connection, those are the same everywhere you go. Those don't change. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from. That need for connection with other human beings and the capacity to really care about them and make their lives better. But just the experience of, you know, a small woman walking down a street late at night and a big guy walking down the street late at night. They're on the same street, but they're living two different things.
Mm-hmm.
And on that level, we don't experience the world the same way. But underneath that capacity for human connection, that's there everywhere.
Yeah, we're all us. It's just a big us out there, I think.
Yeah.
Is Ireland becoming anti-immigrant?
Oh, we shouldn't be. You know, of all the places that shouldn't be, we've sent out so many people as immigrants to other places. We should not be getting anti-immigrant. Problem is, there are people who are taking advantage of all the political problems here to feed an anti-immigrant narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
well, yeah.
For example, we've got a housing crisis, right? We've got healthcare crises. The healthcare system is a mess. There's not enough housing. And this is not the fault in any way of immigrants. But the government isn't listening or doing enough about people who have these problems. So when people go, look, we need houses, we need better healthcare, we need school places. And they go, oh, be quiet. That's, you know, don't, you know, it's fine. It's all, you know, we're doing what we can. It leaves a really ripe soil for people with an anti-immigrant agenda to come in and go, we'll listen to you. We're the only ones who listen to your right. problems. And all of a sudden you've got people who are being kind of siphoned off towards an anti-immigrant agenda where they really didn't start out. This wasn't their point in saying we don't have enough housing in this place. But that's who steps in right. and funnels
well,
them off.
We're living it here, Tana, as well. But, you know, and I've heard things about Ireland, and I picked it up from a cabbie maybe it was in Galway earlier, late last year, you know, just started going off on the problems with people coming in, just as you said, and in his mind, taking advantage of the rules and regulations and the situations. Okay, enough about that. Do you have a soundtrack when you write?
No. I have as much peace and quiet as I can get with, you know, two kids and a cat.
Because one of the coolest things you did for me was reinforce my affection for the song, the band Fontaines D.C.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Are you a fan?
Yeah, off and on. I don't get enough music time these days. But yeah, I discovered them a while back and just went, these guys are great.
Yeah.
Ireland's coming up with great stuff.
There was a scene in the second book, I think it was, where the tunes were coming out through the window. And I'm like, I'm listening to them right now. I love that.
Yes. Got to blast that as well. You need to turn them up loud.
Oh, I think so. Did I read you have another book coming out this year, or was it in reference to this one?
No, it would have been this one. Yeah, no, okay. I'm just getting stuck into the next one. So it's nowhere near ready, no.
Is it going to have Candy in the Pinata, or is it going to be a standalone?
This is definitely a standalone because it is set during the first COVID lockdown, which was a really weird time. And you may have noticed that in the Cal Hooper books, there's no COVID. I could not even with COVID. Like, I had just had it in the searcher when COVID hit, and people kept going, well, are you going to write about this? I was like, no, God, no, I don't even want to do it. Never mind, yeah. Write about it. So in The Hunter and The Keeper, there's no COVID. But I've come back to it now, and I'm writing about a small suburb during those 7 weeks of the first lockdown.
Yeah, you guys were tough too, right? I mean, the police would pull people over, but my cousin liked to go out and jog through the Guinness Park, right, in Rahini. And he'd have to hide from the police or show his address, right, that he wasn't too far from his home.
Yeah, it was 2 kilometers from home for a while there.
Okay, so you've allowed me to ramble here and going off of different topics, and I appreciate you talking to me. But one other thing that jumped at me, one of my favorite books about the Troubles, and I'm sorry I don't have the author's name, a few years ago, was Say Nothing, which you're probably familiar with. Are you?
The book I have heard of it, but haven't read it.
Okay, so that's fine, because the reason was I thought that the phrase Say Nothing was a relatively independent phrase, and yet it was in your book a number of times this time.
Oh yeah, that's an old one that goes back. Whatever you say, say nothing.
Right.
It's Troubles. It's linked to the Troubles, definitely. That idea that just say nothing. Anything you say can and will be used against you, not by the police, but by everybody around you, can easily be used. And it's very much a feature of Irish cultures. People will come at things obliquely and elliptically, and anything right. that's being said to you is probably going to be said in a bunch of concealed ways before anybody actually comes around to saying it straight out.
That brings us back to Mart, doesn't it? Say everything and say nothing.
Oh yeah, that's him.
Tana, I love your writing. I certainly appreciate your time today, and I wish you the best. Get busy, and I can't wait to read what's next.
Listen, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a joy.
That is Irish writer Tana French. Love talking to Tana all the time. And she's wrapping up her Cal Hooper series with this newest book called The Keeper. Thanks very much for listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I appreciate it. I would love it if you would subscribe to this podcast. You can do that just about anywhere you get your podcasts. And share your friends with it, too. I'd love to hear from you. You can send me an email at stevebertrandonbooks@gmail.com. Until then, keep turning the pages.